Very much for this conference. Muchas gracias para llevarnos a estos territorios del post, al post extractivismo. I will personally have a question, but I would like to offer the audience the possibility to raise questions. Vous pouvez poser des questions, on peut discuter, on peut ouvrir un temps de débat.
This idea of ontological politics, is there a risk of reifying the notion of culture and territory as an equation? You know, there are certain cultures related to certain territories, and that's a war in a situation of war against capitalism or other worlds. How to avoid that in that conception in the context of new rurality, networks that cross spaces, localities, regions, and worlds that are more interrelated, and also cultures that are much in mutual relation. How to avoid this risk of reification?
Je traduis très rapidement. Comment éviter le risque de réification entre des objets, pour des objets qui sont mutuellement reliés?
Bueno, primero que todo agradecerle al profesor Arturo Escobar por su magnífica conferencia. Yo quisiera preguntarle sobre esta última parte en la que usted nos proponía el reemplazo de la categoría de o el concepto de ontología por el de cultura. En la experiencia que hemos tenido hace algunos años en Colombia, en el trabajo con pueblos muy fuertes culturalmente en la Sierra Nevada Santa Marta, hemos intentado pues como este trabajo a través del diálogo de saberes, de la ecología de saberes, y me gustaría mucho saber usted cómo ve esto posible en la vida cotidiana, ¿no? Porque cuando uno intenta construir con un sabedor indígena que habla poco español, que no se siente moderno, ¿sí? O sea, nosotros hablamos de modernidades alternativas, pero ese individuo ni siquiera se ha sentido conquistado, se ha sentido subalternizado por la modernidad, es decir, ha vivido, ha hecho su trayectoria dentro de la comunidad. Y lo que me preocuparía es si esta categoría de la ontología política no nos divide más que unirnos, ¿no? Porque es muy densa, muy compleja. Entonces, ¿cómo se imagina usted esto como en el día a día para aquellos que estamos en el terreno construyendo estos tejidos entre las distintas cosmovisiones?
Si tu me permets, Angela, je vais traduire en français en anglais rapidement, très bref, donc je vais forcément couper un peu court. Est-ce que la catégorie d'ontologie politique est une catégorie qui divise plutôt qu'elle le réunirait? Parce que c'est extrêmement dense, c'est extrêmement complexe, et que la question se pose de savoir comment elle s'incarne dans le quotidien. So the idea is about, is the category of political ontology a divisive one or uniting one? Because it's a too dense and too complex a category to be operational at every level of life. So what's happening at the level of day-to-day life within the indigenous communities of people who don't speak Spanish or who don't feel modern?
Thank you so much for your wonderful thought-provoking talk. Do I need the... Thank you. I just wanted to add maybe something to that question of political ontologies. There's a relational process in political ontologies as well, and what we've seen in Canada, especially with the land claims, which is a political process, there is a passive and an active hybridization through that relationship. And so what we see is that people have to let go of so much of the conditions for maintaining their alternative worldviews when they engage in that political process for negotiating land claims, that the claim about the land becomes something about a land that is completely differently experienced through the process of negotiating for it. So I wonder if you have something to say about that difficulty.
Bueno, una traducción rapidita, que es a propósito del proceso relacional de las ontologías políticas y de que las condiciones para mantener las alternativas o los mundos alternativos están complicadas, por ejemplo, en el caso de negociaciones entre grupos indígenas, pueblos indígenas en Canadá y las autoridades, pues se vienen construidas de manera distinta la relación al territorio. Donc très rapidement, c'est cette question de processus relationnel dans les ontologies politiques et de la manière dont on fait advenir un monde à travers des processus de négociation et que la construction même du territoire apparaît différemment dans ce processus de négociation avec les autorités tribunales, politiques et autres. C'est bien?
Ok. Great questions. Amazing. Ok. I'm just going to go in order so I don't forget any of them. So beginning with the question in the back about sort of the equating culture and territory. And will that not happen with ontology as well? And I think, yeah, there is a tendency to coincide culture and territory. I think that tendency was problematized by, for instance, indigenous peoples moving to cities. So when you have, in the context of the U.S., for instance, American Indians, many American Indians in cities, living in cities, or in the context of Canada, then that creates, that problematizes, sort of, disrupts that connection between culture and territory. I think the same with ontology. Ontology is a very risky concept. And maybe I'll say it right away. My feeling is that it's a provisional concept. It's a provisional concept that allows us the group of researchers for now, to say things that we can no longer say with culture, or we can no longer say with any ready-made concept within the Western theory, Western social theory, episteme, configuration of Western social theory. Even if, paradoxically, we use a Western term, ontology, to say things that supposedly we cannot say with other Western social theory categories. But I think it's a provisional concept. And it's a provisional concept that resonates with some things that indigenous peoples, some ethnic minorities, have been telling us all along. It's not just about culture. And maybe I'll tell an anecdote, an example from Marisol de la Cadena. Marisol de la Cadena is a Peruvian anthropologist working in the U.S. Who's written some of the most fascinating things about this. She has an article from 2010. I wish it were published in French. It is also in Spanish. In which it starts with this case. In the Peruvian Andes, there's a group of indigenous peasants facing a transnational mining company who was going to destroy part of the mountain, say a mountain, a sacred, what we consider to be a sacred mountain, Ausangate. And they start mobilizing the mountain as a sentient being, as a living being in a way, against the mining exploitation and concession. So she asks the question, in what ways do you usually interpret that? We moderns say, well, yeah, it is a belief. They believe the mountain is sentient. We moderns, of course, we know that that's not true. A mountain is a piece of rock. It's an inert geological formation. It's a collection of minerals, what have you. Let's let them have the belief. It is their culture. But we know we have the truth. And on the grounds that we have the truth, and that only us, scientists and politicians, can speak the truth because they don't have fully the ability to speak the truth because they are still indigenous and primitives, whatever, then we decide what's good for the nation. And what's good for the nation is progress and development, so the mining goes on. So she asked the question, how do we take really, really seriously, at face value, literally, the fact that the mountain is indeed a sentient being? And the only way in which we can do that is that we shift from culture to ontology, at least for now. That's a provisional formulation. So ontologically, for this group of people, the mountain is a sentient being. It's not a piece of rock. It's alive, in some sense. If we accept that, we take it at face value, then our notion of politics has to change. Non-humans are also political entities, political beings. Our notions about who speaks for humans also has to change. So what Latour calls the modern constitution shifts completely, because then non-humans have also political rights, and non-experts have the right to speak and speak the truth about their worlds. So it's a very interesting example, the one that, and we know from our own cases, you know, in field research. Of course, I forgot about that.
Vous êtes tout à l'aise avec l'anglais, formidable. Donc on passe, c'est pas la traduction.
Okay.
Ça va?
I will speak more slowly. Okay. So, still on the first question, very quickly. So when this movement of black communities from the Pacific begins to tackle the question of displaced Afro-Colombians in cities like in Cali, they say we have to extend the notion of territory. It's not going to be the same as in the Pacific, but it's still a notion of territory that is connected somehow with what goes on in the Pacific, because they came from there. Okay, so that's, there will be much more to say about that, but okay. La pregunta de Angela. Sí, Ángela era. Sí, bueno. I think the concept of diálogo de saberes, dialogue among knowledges, that was introduced in Colombia and many parts of Latin America in the 90s for having these new kind of conversations between indigenous peoples and activists and movements and NGOs and the academy, was a very interesting move towards something that we can now call more ontological. I don't think it was quite there, but the insight was there. The insight of diálogo de saberes, savoir in French, forms of knowledges, is it underlies the idea that at the basis of these different knowledges are different worlds. It's not just the same. So that was sort of moving towards there. I agree with you completely. It's a very dense category. It's an opaque category. It's not user-friendly. So we have to find, and that's the challenge, cosmovision is the more sort of activist-friendly notion, but it's not quite the same either, although to some extent it gets there. We have to find, you know, collectively find better terms to read. And whether it divides or unites, I think, actually, the imposition of a one-world ontology divides even more, because it heightens the distance between local worlds among themselves and makes them closer to the one world. So in a sense, what has to happen is more greater connections and more intense connection among those plural worlds, plural universes, if you wish, that happen all over the world. I mean, as I was saying, including the global north. I mean, Global North is not just this monolith of dualist Cartesian toys, by no means. But that's, it's something along those lines, but that's a very good question. Political ontology. Caroline? Hello. So we have, I'll speak about the Colombian experience first and see if it makes sense. When these movements engage with the state, why do they do it? And there is a debate right now in some South American circles, at least, which involves both activists and intellectuals and academics, about the limits of the engagement with the state. There is a tendency of more autonomistas. I mean, some of you know, for instance, Gustavo Esteva or Raúl Sivecki, who say nothing with the state. You know, any engagement with the state is an opportunity to be damaged. So for get minimized, it's sort of the Zapatistas strategy, okay? Zapatistas have tried to minimize and build autonomous communities. The Caracoles, Juntas de Buen Gobierno, what have you. So build, strengthen local economy, autonomy. Forget about the state. Most movements, including the movement with which I worked, always engage with the state. Always have to negotiate, because the state is pushing, and they know the state in many ways defines the conditions under which their communities live. So they have to engage with the state. One of the activists put it in a really interesting way to me once. He said, well, we all have these battles with the state. Most times we lose. But the times we tie makes us the courage to go on. So they tie sometimes, from time to time they win victories. In the Pacific, over 5.5 million hectares have been collectively titled to black communities. I don't want to suggest that this was just an accomplishment of the movements. It was a very complex set of interactions between the state, neoliberal multiculturalism, movements, NGOs, all of those different things. But the thrust of the movements was super important in that. So my only sort of answer to that is that how, to what extent do they do it? Do they engage with the state, with the political process? Both from a position of autonomy over the terms of engagement, you know, this movement, these movements in Colombia say, well, yeah, it's not the state that is dictating the terms of reference, it is us who are dictating it. I mean, that sounds like, you know, wishful thinking, but it's not. In actuality, many of these activists are very clear. We engaged with the state in our own terms. We know that the state in many ways set the terms, especially through the legality of the space that the state creates. But nevertheless, we determine to some extent at least the conditions of this change. The second thing that I will say is, and this goes to a concept of Eduardo Viveiros de Castro, the Brazilian anthropologist, talks about what he calls uncontrolled equivocations. He says, oftentimes, like in the example that I gave from Marisol de la Cadena, the indigenous peasants opposing the mining on the grounds that the mountain is a sentient being is a case of an uncontrolled equivocation defined as they are disagreeing, but they don't really fully know what they are disagreeing about. Because in the last instance, they're disagreeing about incommensurable, incompatible visions of the world. So they say the more clear we make the equivocation, we move from uncontrolled equivocation to controlled equivocation, because the equivocation cannot be fully eradicated, the more the political process is more clearly about what it's about. So that. And yes. Yeah, and that's it's such a, so I know it's going to be part of the conference. I didn't get the chance to talk about this here, but let me say a couple of things about this, and then about the last question is, and the movements in Colombia, these black movements in particular, are so focused on that now, because it's so crucial. Both libre consulta y consentimiento libre previo informado, el derecho a la libre consulta y consentimiento previo libre informado, the right to a free consultation, and what is the official? Informed consent.
Free prior and informed consent free. As a right to yes. Indigenous peoples.
Exactly.
And tribal peoples.
Tribal peoples, Afro-descendants. That it is the legal, international and national legal tool that has allowed some of the most tense and most interesting engagements as well between some of these movements and the state around extractivist operations in particular. But maybe we can talk a little bit about one. And finally, quick. This Heidegger is kind of always in the background of many of these debates, especially his insistence of the unity of being in the world. It's not that they have been from the one side and the world and the other, it's always being in the world. And philosophy of difference has a very long career in European philosophy. I mean, Deleuze and Guattari is one of the most important sources of inspiration for many people writing today about difference and non-duality from a relational perspective as well. So that's in the background as well. I usually choose to foreground some Latin American authors just because of geopolitical epistemic goals, I guess. But yes, they're absolutely right.
Thank you very much for your presentation. As you'll see in the next few days, I am very sympathetic to the position you're taking, but I wanted to raise three problems. One is in relation to the internal contradiction of late capitalism, neoliberalism, that's founded on the principle of competition. Under those circumstances, why does late capitalism look to creatively destroy anything that's different and promulgate monopoly when monopoly is creating a global crisis? So it's really, I want to problematise that issue. The second point that I wanted to raise is or ask is whether in relation to the state, are you joining James Scott and David Graeber?
Sorry, in relation to?
The question of relations with the state.
Or with the state.
Are you joining James Scott and David Graeber and calling for two or three cheers for anarchism? And thirdly, in relation to the state, you don't seem to raise a situation of structural dependence on the state. And so I suppose I ask, in those circumstances, to what extent can the state, can Indigenous groups, small groups, engage with the state on their own terms, or is this just a discursive strategy? If you're structurally dependent on the state and the state wields power, how do you become autonomous from the state?
Muchas gracias. Thanks. Thank you for your inspiring talk. You made me think about a lot of things, and I really love it when people make me think. And I want to suggest a few things and then ask you a question at the end. In looking at, you talked about the origins in Latin America, where these concepts come from, territory, and you talked about self-determination as well. I would suggest you take a look at the proceedings of the UN Work Group of Indigenous Peoples, especially in its early years, and I would suggest that you look at the Iroquois delegation. I think they had a very important role there. And a lot of that's documented in Akwesasne Notes, which was a newspaper published by the Mohawk in the 1970s up through maybe the mid-80s. People like John Mohawk, Orrin Lyon, Michael Myers, and so forth. And there was a Cuban there, Jose, as well. But there were three concepts, I think, that came out of that UN process that were very important. One was territory, and it was expressed in terms of rights, right to recognition of a territory. The second was self-determination, and looking at self-determination as a wide variety of choices about your relationship with the state. And the third, which you didn't mention, and I'm curious to know why you didn't mention it, is peoples. Recognition of indigenous ethnic groups, tribes, nationalities, et cetera, as peoples. And the three of them went together. It might be interesting for you to think about the peoples. And I mean, that might be the cultures. That might be that aspect of it all. And then I would suggest, finally, for Latin America, you look at the founding of COICA as the point where those concepts were introduced.
What year was it founded?
84. Introduced to ONIC in Colombia, to the organizations in Ecuador, in Brazil, to Bolivia, and so forth. And it was introduced by a lawyer, U.S. lawyer, who worked with the Iroquois in their delegation at the UN. Anyway, my question is around peoples. Why wasn't that mentioned?
Bueno, buenas tardes. Muchas gracias por la conferencia. y muy ilustrativa también del, del trabajo que hacemos. Yo quería hacerte una pregunta nomás. En el principio de tu conferencia hablabas de cómo emergió el concepto o la reconceptualización de la tierra y el territorio y el territorio como derecho y el escenario de los años 90 como la lucha por la consolidación también del punto de vista legal del territorio, ¿no? Porque no nos olvidemos que el movimiento indígena, por lo menos en América Latina, situó el tema legal como un tema fundamental, más allá de lo que dice Boaventura. Se agarró de la legislación y la moldeó y la modificó para que este derecho sea incluido en la legislación. Los casos de Ecuador y Bolivia son representativos de cómo de ese escenario de la lucha solamente por el territorio se llega a plantear la demanda de transformar el Estado el planteamiento del Estado plurinacional. Hecho que en la década pasada llegó tal vez a su máxima expresión con asambleas constituyentes, con modificaciones o transformaciones estructurales fundamentales en el plano formal. La pregunta mía es cómo analizás, tal vez no es tan antropológica mi pregunta, sino más bien política, ¿cómo ves el escenario político actual de América Latina en esos países? Desde el punto de vista de las decisiones económicas que afectan derechos indígenas en este momento. Fundamentalmente en el bloque progresista, podemos llegar a decir así, en donde hay una, a mí me parece, un contraste entre movimientos indígenas que dieron origen a estos procesos y decisiones políticas de sus gobiernos que se contraponen a estos derechos y cómo o qué respuesta le damos en esos contextos que son diferentes al colombiano, al mexicano, al peruano incluso, ¿no?
Bueno, pues un gusto escucharte después de haberte leído tanto y yo quería hacerte solo dos muy breves preguntas. En tus libros y en tu pensamiento siempre es muy crítico con respecto al valor, al poder con que ciertos conceptos se han impuesto desde el mundo occidental hacia otros mundos, ¿no? Empezando por el concepto del desarrollo, el del tercer mundo, etcétera. Me llama la atención que utilices un concepto tan claramente eurocéntrico como el de la ontología, ¿no? Que es un concepto, bueno, que nos remite a la filosofía griega y pues quizás al núcleo central de la, pues solo te faltó decirle metafísica, ¿no? del pensamiento occidental, ¿no? Entonces, en sí mismo no es ya un discurso, digamos que trata de que ejercer por sí mismo un poder, en el sentido de Foucault. Bueno, dos, ¿por qué no te gusta, o hiciste alguna aclaración, pero me gustaría que lo explicaras más, ¿por qué no te gusta utilizar el concepto de interculturalidad? ¿Qué límites le ves al concepto de interculturalidad? Que es un discurso, por cierto, que está ya, digamos, que está también utilizado políticamente por los estados y demás, pero que yo creo que también está muy asimilado en los movimientos indígenas. Bueno, muchas gracias.
Arturo is not using the concept of interculturality, which has a lot of relevance in Latin America, more than in any other place of the world, I would say.
Sí, bueno, primero que todo, muchas gracias por la charla, que no solamente fue muy interesante, sino también muy, muy bonita. Yo quería hacerle una pregunta que tiene que ver con una cosa muy antigua, una reflexión del maestro Orlando Falsborda en uno de los prólogos de su libro La Invención del Tercer Mundo, que tenía justamente que ver con los vínculos de la investigación y de la política. Y usted mencionó, bueno, ya llevan 20 años trabajando con el PCN y esto es realmente ya una historia de amor. Yo quisiera saber un poco como los vínculos de retroalimentación que tiene con la gente de la comunidad. Y bueno, pues decirle que realmente estoy impactada con el nivel, digamos, del discurso, pero que supongo que es más que el discurso como de la ontología misma, de la praxis de esta gente. Que ha tenido que sufrir, digamos, estos embates del capitalismo y de los megaproyectos en sus territorios, pero que ahora se ven confrontados también a algo muy difícil, que es al fraccionamiento de sus comunidades, justamente con herramientas tan interesantes como la que usted mencionaba, de la OIT, del consentimiento previo, libre e informado, y que tiene que ver con organizaciones supuestamente comunitarias ad hoc que han dado ese consentimiento, pero sin tener, digamos, la legitimidad para eso. No sé si está claro. Gracias.
Well, I will very briefly say that you've been asking questions about the link between research and politics and how the kind of thought that you are developing is now going back to the community at the level of community people. And how the people who've been suffered of the assault of capitalism and the fragmentation of the community now are impulsed to resist and to formulate position through the instrument of the ILO Convention 169, question of free, prior, informed consent, and the model of organizations. So, can you just reply, and then we will conclude.
Okay. There is one part of your question that I didn't understand in the first part, but I'm going to try to answer it. If not, we can talk afterwards about sort of the moment of contemporary capitalism, sort of late capitalism, global capitalism today, and how that capitalism treats difference and the contradictions within that, but also the tendency towards monopoly. Is that right? Monopoly, capital, monopoly, yeah, and that's what it is. And the concentration, and this is, you know, you find it even in the tables of the World Bank, World Development Report, or UNDP, Human Development Report, the concentration of wealth worldwide and of the ownership of corporations is just becoming staggering. And the last 34 years have been decades of increasing accumulation at the top. Sort of, I was listening recently to a talk by Saskia Sassen, who's written some about these things, global cities, global capitalism, and she says what is consolidated is a super rich middle class. I mean, it's sort of a middle class, but a middle class with much greater purchasing power and affluence worldwide. So in the global north, we have more people at the top, more people and with more wealth at the top, and more and more people in the bottom, very, you know, dispossessed, increasingly dispossessed. So in that sense, I think capitalism proceeds by both creating difference and heterogeneity, both homogeneity and heterogeneity at the same time. If we look at, for instance, the agro-fuel plantations in the Pacific, the way in which it treats labor and territory and rights at the local level is very different from what it would treat it in different parts of the world. But at some level, it is about exploiting labor power and exploiting resources in the cheapest possible way. So it does create heterogeneity with certain limits, but it does create, I mean, in my mind, it does tend to create universalized individual-based, market culture, market-based kinds of culture. So we are all increasingly exist within a world defined fundamentally by markets. And rights and equality are defined in terms of our ability to perform well in markets. And globalization, and in the universities, I think we train people increasingly to perform well in a globalization defined in terms of markets. And that requires a certain worldview, certain ontology. But that's part I didn't understand too well. But the second part is about the state. Okay. The Two or Three Cheers for Anarchism is the title of a new book by James Scott, which I bought about a month ago and I haven't read. But knowing some of his work, I think I'm going to like it. And I think, and this is about, goes back to transitions as well. I mean, transitions, there's this whole movement, some of you might know about the Transition Town Initiative that started in the UK. The transitions towards relocalized food systems, energy systems, transportation systems, autonomy and democracy. So it's about going back, anarchism in the good sense of the term. I mean, anarchism got a bad rap, you know, in the 2000s because of the anti-globalization movements and the anarchists that destroyed windows and private property and all these different things. That is part of the anarchist movement, but it's not all of the anarchist movement. And philosophical anarchism, again, a philosophy of the West, but we have some connections with, I mean, Orlando Falsborda was, I talked with him, Colombian socialist, many times about this. He was a social anarchist. He would call himself anarcho-socialista, a socialist anarchist, in the sense that he did believe in local and regional autonomies as a fundamental value vis-a-vis the state. And yet, at the same time, the state is a power to contend with. I mean, yeah, you put it very well. And many movements are structurally dependent on the state. So that's sort of the give and take about democratizing the state and the state apparatus at the same time, making the state more sensitive to local demands and local conditions. But at the same time, strengthening its local autonomy. In the last instance, it's what is going to defend these communities. I think. And so again, the Zapatistas are the model, one particular model in that connection with a localizing anarchist type of politics. And that's why they have resonated so much with anti-globalization movements. I agree with you completely. My ignorance, practically, since I've been working much more on Afro-descendant issues and learning about indigenous issues along the way. I spent 10 years in Massachusetts and got the chance to know John Mohawk a number of times, really impressive, and heard about and read some of the Akwesame notes. But great, I hadn't made the connection. So good is an excellent idea. Go back and to this founding moment of the United Nations, the UN Working Group on Indigenous Affairs, and the Iroquois declarations, contributions, and the different contributions, and see how we reread them in terms of ontological politics. I mean, they were ontological politics in so many ways. Peoples is not a concept that comes up too much in Afro-descendant struggles. Moreover, there was a moment in which the PCN, this group of activists, applied for support from IGIA, the International Work Group for Indigenous Affairs in Copenhagen. But it came down to a conclusion. For them to get support from IKEA, they had to declare themselves as a pueblo. And they had this debate, and they decided not to declare themselves as a pueblo, even foregoing the... So interesting, is ethnic groups very different? Maybe not, but that's kind of an interesting discussion. But yes, I would love to go back and learn more about this. Leonardo's question. Yes. The situation of countries, there is Maristeles Vampa, an Argentinian sociologist, makes an interesting distinction between sort of neo-extractivist regimes, like conventional neoliberal neo-extractivist regimes like Mexico and Colombia, in many ways Peru as well, and conventional extractivism, I think that's one. Then neo-extractivism, which are the progressive regimes. And then the debates about transitions to post-development, alternatives to development, buen vivir, all these different things like that. So there is this Uruguayan ecologist whose name is Eduardo Godinas. You probably know him. He's been writing a lot about this post-transitions to post-extractivism And he has this very interesting concept in one of his papers, por la izquierda al postextractivismo. What he means by that is that we have to go through the left. I mean, there's no other way. We have to work with the Correas and Chavez's and Morales's, but we know that they are, at the same time, they are very problematic, especially from ecological and indigenous perspectives. So that's why many indigenous movements, as you well said it, that were originally in support of these progressive left regimes, have withdrawn from the government, from the coalitions, and their support, and they are now in opposition. And the opposition takes different forms in different countries, but I think it's a very important opposition. I mean, my own personal solution to that is we have to support, you know, the left governments, because they are so much, especially coming from Colombia, they are so much better. I mean, Magda, my partner, and I watched the inauguration of Correa about 2 weeks ago in Telesur, and it was so fascinating, the level of discourse, of political discourse, and, you know, very anti-imperialist discourse, very interesting, but at the same time, Correa was so clear. We want to modernize the country. And he warned, he spent like 10 minutes talking about you indigenous people, you environmentalists, you have to basically shut up. So that's the tension and the contradiction that is so real. But then the conditions are different in the progressive regimes than in Colombia or Mexico, where the activists are more readily killed right away. And, yes, Juan. Estamos completamente de acuerdo. I feel ontología, I feel like quite doesn't work yet. I need to study because a lot of people in the science studies field, are using ontology and the ontological turn in geography. Geography people talk about flat ontologies and all this. It's interesting. It's a very interesting trend. So we're going along with the trend for now. But Enrique Dussel, it's a very interesting sort of decolonial philosopher, makes the argument that the West, the modern West, modernity, in a way stole the traditions of the Greeks for its own cultural and political project in sort of post-Renaissance Europe. He said sort of what the West did so successfully was to sort of, in a way, draw an equation, which is Hellenism plus Roman Empire plus Christianity equals modernity, modern West. But he said, no, we have to delink that history from modern Europe because it doesn't really work that way. So I don't know, maybe we can reclaim some sort of Greek term without all of the baggage of sort of the European developments after that. ¿Por qué no usar? I'm almost there. ¿Cuál? Interculturalidad. Yes, no. In the written paper, I use it. There's some great work on interculturalidad being done. We have to use it. And at the same time, you know, we can use this craft of encounters across walls, which is not exactly interculturality, but yes, yeah, definitely. There is a lot of interesting developments in interculturality. And the concept of epistemic decolonization also, as well. And finally, the last one, la tuya. Muchas gracias por la pregunta. Orlando Falsborda was a pioneer of many of these things, and I learned a lot from him. And his notion and movement of participatory action research was the first wave of problematizing the encounter between different rationalities, different worlds, different epistemes or forms of knowledge. Now, in Falsborda's approach to participatory action research, there was still the idea that there was a distinct researcher or a distinct community that came together and together produced a superior knowledge. I think the model that many people like myself are using now in the work with social movements is more of the kind of Xochitl Leyva Solano, is an anthropologist in Chiapas who's worked a lot with Zapatista, coined the term co-labor, co-work, collaboration, co-labor, which is also a beautiful term as well that she uses, which is I think is from the Zapatista, co-razonar, which makes sense in, doesn't make sense in English, but in maybe in French it makes sense, which is corazón is heart, y co-razón is co-reasoning, reasoning with from the heart, so to speak. It's a very interesting idea, and in the collaboration with PCN has been, as you suggested, it hasn't only been writing things, silly things for academics, but an ongoing collaboration in the practice. We've done many, many things together. We're about to do a international forum on other economies based on black experiences in Colombia in July. And there is going to be, about the consulta, where the consulta has been co-opted, is often co-opted by the state, definitely, yes. And it's an ongoing struggle, you know. There's going to be a national congress of black organizations in Quibdó in August, which is going to be largely focused on how to develop a collective approach to the consulta previa, consultamiento previo libre informado. That's a key question now for these movements, and they say we want to really, because the state has been manipulating it continuously to the creation of parallel black organizations, to the appeal and co-optation and buying off of black leaders in some of the communities, many, many different ways in which they can be co-opted. So they are going to do this national congress to deal with this issue in particular.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much, Arturo. Just before we leave, juste avant de nous quitter, je voudrais faire trois annonces. Pour ceux qui s'intéressent à la question des peuples autochtones, indigenous peoples, the relationality, la relationalité et l'importance d'être reconnu comme peuple, as peoples, je vous informe de la sortie du premier volume des travaux de SOGIP qui vient après le premier workshop que l'on a eu. So after the first workshop that we had about the question of recognition, so we have this book, which is on indigenous people in the world and the challenges of recognition as peoples. Évidemment, c'est une très bonne lecture que je vous recommande. Si vous souhaitez l'acheter, on peut vous le faire à prix d'auteur aujourd'hui. Donc, ça sera 30 € si vous le désirez. So, it's in French. I'm sorry, it has not been translated in Spanish or in English. It's important, it should be. But I made it in French, and we made it in French with all the colleagues of SOGIP and other colleagues who have been associated, because we need to establish a platform of debate of this issue in French. Que no hay en francés la misma posibilidad de discutir de las cuestiones de pueblos indígenas en francés, como lo hay en América Latina, por ejemplo. Entonces, lo pusimos en francés para que la gente se enterara de lo que significa efectivamente las demandas de reconocimiento. Second announcement, I would like to thank very much all the members of SOGIP that you are going to meet in the next 3 days. Yves-Marie Davenel, Marion Dupuis, Veronica Gonzalez, Leslie Clou, Laurent Lacroix, Robina Dickinson, Jennifer Ace. Je pense qu'il y en a au moins 4 autres qui ne sont pas là, mais ils sont également remerciés. Stéphanie Guillon, Benoît Trépied. Voilà, je crois que j'ai fait le tour. Moi-même, je suis donc la responsable de l'EHSS-OGIP. Je voudrais remercier l'EHESS pour nous avoir prêté cet amphithéâtre. I would like to thank EHESS, the High School for Social Studies, Advanced Studies in Social Sciences, because they just opened the space for us. Je voudrais remercier en particulier Philippe Cagresse qui a assuré la caméra qui est là et qui va nous permettre d'avoir cette conférence en ligne. So I want to thank Philippe who's been on the camera and who is going to put the conference online. No, we are going to make it so that it can be put online. Le agradezco muchísimo a Philippe Cagresse. Les agradezco a todos ustedes para estar aquí presentes. Y ahora al final que les invito a participar al cóctel que está afuera. So you are all invited to have a drink outside to breathe some fresh air. Merci beaucoup. Nous vous invitons tous à aller dehors boire un coup. Merci. Philippe aussi t'es invité.
¿Me puede dar un libro o está para la venta? ¿Una copia?
Sí. a ti te puedo dar la cosa.